Welcome to the Florida Roundup statewide edition today. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Tom, in less than 11 months, Florida voters will choose a new governor. And they'll also decide if the state's current Democratic U.S. Senator, Bill Nelson, should be sent back to Washington. Those are the two big political races at the top of the ballot in the 2018 midterm elections.
Yeah, Melissa, this promises to be a long and expensive election year here in the Sunshine State. More than a half dozen candidates already are off and running for governor, and the current governor is widely expected to turn his attention to challenging Senator Nelson for that seat in the U.S. Senate. Then we have at least five of Florida's congressional districts that are seen as battleground districts as Democrats look to pick up seats and Republicans aim to shore up the majority that they have on Capitol Hill. And of course, then Hurricane Maria. It may well reshape politics as Puerto Ricans move to Florida and vote this fall.
That's right. Really something to watch. And so we're going to begin our look ahead at 2018 in Florida with those crucial midterm elections as we welcome to the show Adam Smith, political editor of the Tampa Bay Times, Mark Caputo, who writes for Politico, and Diane Roberts with FSU, NPR, and also a columnist for Flamingo Magazine. Adam Smith, let's talk about Rick Scott's moves. In recent days, there have been a few rumblings that maybe Governor Scott is reassessing whether he will challenge Senator Bill Nelson. What are you hearing about this? Is it a sure thing that Scott's going to go for that Senate seat?
I think it's about as sure a thing as you can get. Now, he's going to he has the luxury of being worth $14 gazillion, so he can wait. But, you know, barring the polling looking suggesting that Trump is going to destroy every Republican's chances, I think it's pretty clear that Rick Scott is getting ready to run against Bill Nelson.
And you've seen the governor sort of calibrating his stances in recent months on a number of issues, just tacking a little bit more toward the political center. What are some of the biggest ways you've noticed that, Mark Caputo?
Well, his budget. Remember that a proposed budget is really a political document. It says these are my values. And when Scott first came into office, albeit at a down economy in 2011, he had a pretty austere budget that he proposed for Florida. His last budget that he's proposing is just so much more spending, and it gives a lot to everybody. And it's certainly a sign that he is not going to be attacked as a miser. One thing back to what Adam was saying and the original question that led this off, one of the problems with the news media as a whole is that we have, especially in concert with social media, an echo chamber that creates kind of a game of telephone where a word goes in at the beginning and it comes out all distorted. Hmm. So a New York Times story was written that said the governor has not, quote, been sold on running for Senate, which is true because he's not an announced candidate. And this wound up being transmogrified or transformed into him reconsidering. Not true. He's not reconsidering. He just hasn't made his mind up. But I do believe, like Adam does, that he'll run. I won't be utterly shocked if he doesn't.
Diane Roberts,
looks like he's running. Sorry, go ahead.
No, let me ask you to that point about how he looks like he's running and the budget that he proposed and the kinds of spending programs that he has advocated here in his eighth budget as governor, obviously much different than that first-year budget as Mark represents. But Diane, I think one of the places you can see the governor kind of tacking a little bit is on the environment and the environmental spending.
Absolutely. And you will have noticed that when the governor was up for re-election, all of a sudden he was going around the state. I mean, the last time, not this time.
2014,
going around the state. He even got some, reported environmentalists to kind of hang out with him. The head of Audubon was there, and he discovered for about 6 months that the environment was a great thing. Then he went back to doing what he does. So now the environment's a great thing again, and we have to, help the Everglades, and we have to think about clean water. And, I figure that's as calculated as it can be. Of course, all politicians are.
Well, he's also taken that message to the Republican in the Oval Office, President Trump, and he has talked about securing more money.
That's working out well, isn't it?
He's talked about securing more money for Everglades restoration in a faster pace and speeding up the spending around the Hoover Dyke and the southern edge of Lake Okeechobee.
Every governor of Florida that I can recall, and I I'm ancient, has asked for money to deal with Everglades restoration.
I guess
the dike around Lake Okeechobee is, yes, absolutely he has. But you know, there are a lot of, shall we say, skeptical people in the environmental community because we have seen this movie
before. You've seen it before. So Adam Smith, okay, a minute ago, Tom mentioned President Trump. How do you see the Trump factor in Florida affecting this Senate race? Because certainly you can expect Senator Nelson to try to tie Rick Scott very closely to wherever Donald Trump is politically next year. But Donald Trump did win the state of Florida. So what about the Trump factor when you look at this race?
Well, absolutely. I think Trump is going to be the shadow that hangs over every single race. We don't quite know if he's going to be a slight drag, a wash, or a huge drag. But there are certainly a lot of anxious Republicans. And Bill Nelson, in this case, would be absolutely fair in wrapping Donald Trump around Rick Scott, because Rick Scott was an early and eager supporter of the president, more so than most Republicans. He's certainly going to be closely associated with whatever happens with Obamacare, which has the potential to antagonize a lot of voters, and immigration policy, which is when we've got all these Puerto Ricans, Democratic-leaning Puerto Ricans, 200,000 or 300,000 or more coming to Florida.
The Puerto Rican factor, Mark Caputo, can that be decisive on the margins? Will there be enough Democratic-leaning Puerto Rican voters next year to really affect the outcome?
Well, potentially, but as you said, on the margins in a very close election, every vote counts. Yeah, heck, we just had a state house race in Virginia, which was decided by a point or a vote.
One vote.
But remember this, is that of the voters, when broken down demographically by the race and ethnicity, those of Puerto Rican descent have a pretty abominable turnout rate. And so we keep hearing about the sleeping dragon of the Puerto Rican vote, and it never quite materializes. Now, the question is, we've had at least 240,000 people from Puerto Rico who have arrived in at least three ports since Hurricane Maria. A lot of those people could register to vote if they vote. If they vote in their numbers with other people in their communities, yeah, it'll make a difference. But there's a lot of ifs there, and certainly you have to have the right candidate, and you have to have the right party and campaign to harness those votes.
How vulnerable?
This is true.
How vulnerable is Senator Nelson here?
Oh, I think he's very vulnerable, but he's fortunate to be running in a midterm election of an unpopular president. Generally, a president's party and the politicians in it get punished at a midterm, especially if the president is unpopular. That seems to be the condition that Donald Trump is in. However, in midterm elections in Florida, Republican-leaning voters tend to overperform Democratic-leaning ones.
Adam, is that the Senator Nelson strategy here to paint a possible candidacy from Governor Scott as a Trump 2.0 versus a policy record that Senator Nelson wants to run on, given his many years of service in the U.S. Senate?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, Rick Scott versus Bill Nelson means we will have the most boring U.S. Senate race.
expensive, but boring.
Oh, expensive. And monotonic.
You know, look, Nelson, he's been blessed with very, very weak Republican opponents in the past. He's not very well known. He does have a profile, sort of Southern fried, non-controversial vanilla that often does well in Florida. But he's never had a candidate with the kind of resources that Rick Scott has.
Diane Roberts, what about that dynamic with Nelson? You're a seventh or eighth generation Floridian. When you look at Bill Nelson, he's sort of the last old style Dixiecrat left standing at this high a level of politics.
I wouldn't call him a Dixiecrat.
You wouldn't go that far?
I think that's way too right-wing to describe Bill Nelson. I mean, Strom Thurmond was a Dixiecrat.
To tie him to that sort of politics. What I'm saying is that he's sort of a moderate old-school
Democrat.
He's
the last white Southern Democrat from Florida that could run in this race. He and Rick Scott both have what you might call troubled speaking styles. Nelson's a little bit more eloquent, but that ain't saying much. He tends to do fairly well in small groups of people. He's not an inspiring guy at a big rally, but then neither is Scott, so maybe that's a wash. It's going to be real interesting to see if the Florida Democratic Party can manage to get these new Puerto Ricans registered and motivated to vote, should they wish to, you know, be Democrats. I don't think the Florida Democratic Party is what anyone would describe as a well-oiled machine. But, you know, you notice that Scott, especially during Hurricane Maria, was making all the right noises at Puerto Rico. I mean, he was being well advised that being nice to Puerto Ricans might pay off in the end, especially given the contrast between the way he was welcoming and the way Donald Trump just ignored the place, I guess not remembering that they're all American citizens. And it would be a splendid irony if those citizens who can't vote for these offices in Puerto Rico come to Florida and change the color of the state, at least to a deep purple.
So whatever the future holds for Governor Scott, we know that there will be a new governor elected in 2018, this year, and taking office in 2019. As you look at that race, Mark, shaping up here early in the year, there are certainly those candidates that have been kind of deemed the front runners, mostly because of the kind of money that they've been able to attract. But for the Republicans, is it a race that's going to be based on Governor Rick Scott's legislative agenda, which comes down to three things: jobs, jobs, jobs?
Yeah. You know, I think certainly after the last election, 2016, it's difficult to really predict what people are going to do. Even the objective polling, even in aggregate, sometimes is wrong. What I can say is that Florida just has a tendency to pick characters, sometimes, you know, strange characters. Rick Scott is kind of a strange character. You know, Bill Nelson is a kind of an oddball character that we're talking about. He's just kind of a bit of a throwback. So we've had a tendency to, you know, we like different types of people. And so I have absolutely no idea which way Florida goes. Now, in the governor's race, Adam Putnam is just, he's socking away a lot of money. He's an old-time Floridian. He has...
A young guy, but an old-time Floridian.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he is a career politician. I mean, he's in his early 40s, and I think he's been in elected office continually since he's been almost in college or right out of college. So, you know, it looks like right now we're looking at an Adam Putnam versus Gwen Graham race. Gwen Graham being the former congresswoman from Tallahassee, who's the daughter of Bob Graham. It's going to be kind of an interesting race, but I don't think, to Adam's point earlier about the Senate race, that the governor's race will be a barn burner either. Now, in the Republican field, there is a potential that Ron DeSantis, a congressman from Northeast Florida, might get in. If mm-hmm. he does, he could possibly unseat Putnam from the far right, but he's going to need the money to do it, and that's unclear if he does. And then there's the X factor of John Morgan, the godfather of medical marijuana, trial lawyer from Central Florida, said he was leaving the Democratic Party, but he hasn't yet.
Right.
He might run still, outside chance for governor. If he does in the Democratic primary, he'd be a very strong contender.
Yeah, and you mentioned Ron DeSantis, and then there's also House Speaker Richard Corcoran. Diane Roberts, Ron DeSantis, this congressman from the 6th District of Florida, we keep hearing he's going to get in, and he's another hard right conservative in the state, member of the Freedom Caucus up on Capitol Hill, who has really tied himself closely to President Trump. And so should he get in, certainly that will be a factor in the race, whereas some of these other Republicans that are running, they really, you think of them more as longtime Florida faces, not so much Capitol Hill figures. But you mentioned DeSantis. He's done a lot of things recently to indicate that he's about to make the announcement. So that's one that's certainly being closely watched here in Northeast Florida.
Well, yes, it is. And he will have that Trump-shaped albatross hanging around his neck. Richard Corcoran was acting more like he was running a little earlier on. He's getting dinged a little bit by some of his high living ways. It was just a great piece in Adams' newspaper about this. But, you know, Corcoran's a young guy. So whatever he does this time out, he's got plenty of chances to jump in later. And he, too, comes from the hard right. And so I don't know what happens then to Putnam, who has some center right positions that are maybe a little more palatable to Floridians who say care about, you know, traditional Florida industries like farming.
Sure. And Adam Smith, what about the center left candidate? Let's talk about the Democrats for a minute. Gwen Graham, as Tom mentioned, she's the daughter of Bob Graham, still a respected political figure in this state. Can she make this a race, or can some of the other Democrats, like the mayor of Miami, Levine, he's got quite a campaign war chest already assembled. As you look at that side of the field, what are your thoughts?
I would say both sides of the field, I think these are wide open races. I think on the Democratic side, Gwen Graham looks like the front runner, but she's really, for somebody that has the Bob Graham name and a lot of the sort of establishment support, she's really not raising much money at all. Unfortunately, money does matter. And Philip Levine is also a very wealthy guy. He's not a career politician. She's not either, but she's associated with Washington. And then just to flip back briefly to the Republican side, in any normal year, Adam Putnam would be the almost sure thing nominee. But this is an era where the Republican Party is so unpredictable, and you've got a guy who was in Congress for 10 years, voting for cash for clunkers and voting for pay raises, et cetera. That race could go anywhere.
I want to bring this back to the issues in the race and the economy. Governor Scott runs successfully on the economy, was elected statewide on the economy and the promise to bring jobs back. While the unemployment rate is historically low in the state of Florida, Mark, Adam, and Diane, are wages going to be the economic issue statewide in the governor's race? And what I mean by that, of course, is the lack thereof, the relatively low median wage jobs that have been created under the Scott administration.
The thing that you have to remember is that if people feel that the economy is good and their situation is good, it's good. And if they don't, they don't. Sometimes these economic indicators make us lose sight of that. There are, however, enough economic indicators out there that suggest a broad swath of Florida is just struggling to get by. And so we had in Politico a story earlier in the month about how the state's economist had basically said that, you know, things aren't as great as people might have you believe. There's a lot of people living paycheck to paycheck.
Absolutely.
And not making much money to start with, you know, making service industry wages, which, you know, yes, it's a job, but it's kind of a mick job rather than a job that you could be super proud of.
It is our statewide look at the biggest stories we're watching for 2018, and we're going to continue the conversation with an amazing panel. It's Adam Smith, political editor of the Tampa Bay Times, Mark Caputo, he reports for Politico, and Diane Roberts, she's a professor at FSU, a commentator on NPR, and a columnist in the statewide Flamingo magazine. The biggest stories of 2018, the year ahead for the state. That's our subject right now on the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition from Florida Public Radio. Keep listening. We'll be right back. And welcome back to the Florida Roundup, our statewide edition. As we look ahead at 2018 here in Florida, I'm Melissa Ross up in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson down in Miami. Happy New Year to you, Melissa.
You too, Tom.
The Florida legislative session is a 60-day right with politicking and posturing. Some public policy decisions certainly get made during those 2 months. But the months leading up to the 2018 session have really been dominated by sex scandals, including a top Republican senator now facing a Senate Rules Committee hearing into his behavior, and allegations of sexual harassment and potentially trading sex for a vote, all of that referred to law enforcement for further investigation.
Right, just eye-popping revelations coming out of that probe. And, of course, Jack Latvala had hopes of becoming governor in 2018, but instead he's been fighting for his political life. An independent Senate investigation found Latvala pressured a female lobbyist for sex in order to get his support for legislation. This followed six other women accusing the senator of sexual harassment, inappropriate comments, and groping.
Meantime, Melissa, there will be some vacant seats when the gavel falls to open up the 2018 legislative session in Tallahassee. One Senate seat is open after Democratic State Senator Jeff Clemens from Palm Beach County resigned after admitting to having an extramarital affair with a female lobbyist last year. And three House seats are vacant for various reasons, including one Democrat who quit after admitted to lying about whether or not she actually lived in the district that she was elected to represent.
Right. So some open seats. The power jockeying is underway, and we're going to begin the Florida Roundup with a look ahead to the biggest trends and stories for 2018 in the Sunshine State as we welcome Adam Smith, political editor at the Tampa Bay Times, Mark Caputo, reporter at Politico, and Diane Roberts of FSU, NPR, and also Flamingo Magazine. Diane Roberts, where you sit in Tallahassee, as you look at these vacant seats there, do you think that's going to have a big impact on votes in committees or the full chambers? How do you see that dynamic playing out in Tallahassee this year?
Well, you know, they're not allowed to raise money while they're in session. So there'll be this hilariously unseemly scramble the week before session as they all go off to parties and collect checks, you know, getting stuffed into their pockets up until the last minute. So the fact that there are elections and open seats always affects how votes go. There will be a great deal of speechifying because, you know, you need that soundbite and that video to put on your web page or in your ads or whatever it is you do. And, you know, here in Tallahassee, I mean, I should say that every time I hear that Tallahassee used as a synonym for, you know, all the evil in the universe, I cringe slightly because I was born here. And, you know, those of us who live here year round kind of don't recognize this picture. We feel invaded by these people. We're occupied territory during session, you know, where we kind of walk down Adams Street carrying a baseball bat like, get away.
Are you referring to the politicians or the reporters that descend on
them? Oh, the politicians. I love the reporters.
There's no reporters left.
Well, all right. All three or four of the reporters who
that are still there
to do the work of 30 or 40 people. I mean, you know, there's a guy at the AP called Gary Fineout that can do the work of 30 or 40 people, best I can tell. But it is a very strange thing to see. And they will pretend that they pivot on the first day of session from being, you know, rabid campaign money raisers to servants of the public good. And that would be funny if it weren't so tragic.
Adam Smith, do you anticipate any more resignations? Are there any more scandals about to pop?
I would say, and I've talked to a fair number of people, I don't recall the atmosphere in Tallahassee being as toxic as it is today, ever, in a long, long time. You've got private eyes spying on each other. You've got political operatives compiling dossiers on reporters. You've got legislators looking over their back to see who's gonna out them for a consensual or otherwise kind of affair. So, you know, I think the political dynamic is the Florida Senate is going to be so bogged down and so with some of these scandals. The Florida House, where Richard Corcoran already dominates Tallahassee, is likely to be even more dominant.
I do think, though, that Latvala is likely either to resign or to be expelled early in the session. If that happens, that will remove some of the toxicity in the Senate. However, the larger problem that the Florida Senate has is Senate President Joe Negron isn't a very strong leader.
But the shadow of all of this over the last couple of months, reporting that's been led by Politico, Mark, the shadow of this has consumed committee weeks. You know that, and your reporters know this. While the business may be getting done in the hearing rooms and in the chambers, in the lobby, in the rotunda, in the bars and in the clubs, the talk is the toxic environment, the sex scandal, the lobbyist-legislator relationship.
Yeah, it will, but I do have a... I don't think that getting rid of Latvala will cure the Senate's problems, but it's going to go a long way to removing a major source of dissension in there. I mean, Senator Latvala took the Senate presidency race against the Senate President Joe Negron to the brink, and that caused a lot of chaos in the Senate for the past year. And so once he's gone, you're just going to see less drama. You're not going to see no drama, but you're going to see less of
but,
it.
But you
in
mentioned
the chamber.
You don't see Joe Negron as a strong leader, and what about his relationship with the House Speaker Richard Corcoran? And by the way, Corcoran has ambitions beyond his current position. What about that dynamic?
Well, Corcoran is, as Adam mentioned, Corcoran is kind of dominates in his chamber and is going to be in a position probably to roll Negron. Now, understand this. The House speakership only lasts for 2 years.
Right.
In the second year of your speakership, you start to lose power. Corcoran does have one kind of ace in the hole, and that's the incoming House Speaker, Jose Oliva, right behind him, is a pal and is not going to undermine him. So he will have a little more force there. Last thing, power in Tallahassee is inversely proportional to your desire. And when people know what you want as a powerful person and you are running for, say, governor, they can just leverage that against you and just cause you trouble.
This is very true, and we've seen it over the years. What I think is going to be interesting, though, is, you know, will we see a change in behavior from legislators? Will they be worried and careful? And we talked a bit another time about the backlash, you know, against women. Will women be shut out of a lot of things lest they, you know, somehow compromise some guy?
Diane, are you talking about the behavior of male legislators toward...
I'm talking about anybody, but male legislators in particular. I mean, you don't have to hang around very long at the governor's club or in bars to see that there is kind of this power structure, which is mostly taken up by men. And they have a way of dealing with women, or they did have a way of dealing with women that could be, patronizing, and I mean, for some people, maybe a bit menacing. Be interesting if anything changes there, if the culture changes.
If the culture changes. And Adam Smith, as this discussion's going on, with this hanging over the 60-day session, how do you see business actually getting done? As Mark said, removing Latvala will deal with some of that, but how to do business in this kind of climate, you know?
It's that hanging over the session, and it's also an election year that's like the mother of all election years with all these open seats. So I think you tend to see sort of small ball legislating. Nobody wants to shake things up too much. I think there's going to be talk about generators in nursing homes, regular budget stuff. But I think it's likely they're going to be pretty cautious about taking pushing big agenda items.
Mark, do you see it the same way? Because
yes.
An election year legislative session is always earlier to let those legislators get loose out from under the rotunda. And for those that are running for reelection or new office, collect those checks that Diane referred to earlier.
Yeah, it's not just an election year. The reason they're having session early in January, they normally have it starting the 60-day session in March, is it's an election year. The other thing is there's money. Money doesn't buy you love, but it puts a down payment on it in the legislature.
But campaign money is what you're referring to.
Well, no, I mean money in the budget. Because, you know, that's the main thing.
The state's flush.
Yeah, the whole reason you have, constitutionally, a legislative session is not to pass all these laws on speeding or texting and driving. It's to have a balanced budget right. for the coming fiscal year. They've got enough money to go around and to kind of buy happiness or rent it, and that's what they're going to do.
Let's talk about the budget. And as you pointed out, the legislators' one duty is to pass the budget. That is their reason for being there. And of course, over the past several years, Diane, you'd think that would not be so difficult, but it has turned out to be extraordinarily difficult to get done in the time allotted.
If you're referring to the fights between the House and the Senate, where you had the phenomenon of one chamber flouncing off. not playing ball with the other chamber for a while there. It's great drama. I mean, it's the best free show in town. I encourage anyone who's in Tallahassee to go sit and watch these people spend your money. And the majesty of democracy is not the thing that will pass through your head. But the
taxpayers
budget,
will say they already are spending the money. Don't they have a ticket? Isn't that already part of the bargain?
I guess it is. But, you know, the money will, as Mark just says, you can rent happiness, even if you can't, money can't buy it. They're going to put money in places that make them look like good guys and gals, a few of them. They're going to make lots of noises about equity and, yes, generators in nursing homes, because we can't have that happen again. And we're going to, you know, there will be a great deal of lip service paid to lots and lots of issues and some money spent, but nothing big and visionary, because we don't do big and visionary, well, much at all, but definitely not in an election year.
Adam, describe the financial situation, though, that the legislature is dealing with. And what I'd like to kind of go back to is that interchamber fighting that we've seen in legislative sessions past. We're not talking about Democrats in one chamber wanting to spend money one way and Republicans in another, and the governor wanting to do something else. All three controlled by, presumably, the grand old party, the same political party, but that's where the tension has been sourced.
Yeah, and this is a party that is so dominant in Tallahassee now that there are all kinds of wings of the party. And this is a party that a lot of people don't recognize who have been in Florida for a while, where Jeb Bush was the big, almost radical conservative, is now too much of a squish to really have a prominent place in today's Republican Party in Florida. But yeah, I think you're looking at Richard Corcoran is a very much of a Milton Friedman, starved government. He has basic contempt for local government. So he will try to limit what they can spend and how they can raise fees. And you've got the Senate that is traditionally more moderate. I think Rick Scott being, he tends to change his shape come election year, but I think he may be more on the side of the Senate than on Corcoran's side.
It's interesting when you talk about that, Adam, because you've got a very conservative legislature in a state that I think it was Diane that pointed out a minute ago is edging toward deep purple. And so as we continue to talk about this, I want to follow up in a moment on that. But right now, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition from Florida Public Radio. What else is on your agenda, Mark Caputo? When you look ahead to the session, what are some of the biggest items that you think people all over the state really need to watch the most closely?
Well, you know, I'm kind of exhausted, to be perfectly honest. You know, in the past 3 months, we have at Politico have wound up reporting at least 5 sexual harassment scandals that have kept us working constantly. We have the Nash and governor's race and the Senate race going. And we have so much money in the budget that nothing for me has really risen to a level where I have to pay attention to. Beyond what we've been doing. Beyond that, the one thing to watch is the legislature's continual mismanagement of effectively regulating medical marijuana so that people who need it can get it, or people whose doctors say they need it can get it. I think that's the one piece of unfinished business that this legislature won't do. And there's also the implementation of the voter-approved constitutional amendment concerning environmental spending that the legislature is continually violating.
Both of those were voter-approved constitutional amendments. But on the medical marijuana side, though, Mark, and
they've hired
Adam,
a complete incompetent.
Is it the mismanagement of the legislature, or it's mismanagement of the state agencies and the bureaucrats?
It's a little bit of both. The Republican Party dominates in Tallahassee, and it's a no-regulation party, and it's a no-drug party. So, oh, I see. So you're going to have the anti-marijuana people write marijuana regulations when they hate writing regulations. Well, guess what's going to happen? Then you have Rick Scott, who also doesn't like medical marijuana, has this Office of Compassionate Use, as they call it. They've hired this guy, Christian Bax, who could screw up a two-car funeral. And so between the two of them, there's nothing's happening. And, you know, it's continually being challenged in court. You've got black farmers who are suing. They say, look, we've been priced out. Yeah. There's a behind-the-scenes battle to see who can be essentially one of the monopolies to grow marijuana. Mm-hmm. But money doesn't grow on trees, but boy, it does if it's marijuana. Mm-hmm. So that's really something for me to watch beyond just kind of the regular refereeing of special interest food fights, which is what the legislature
does. Adam and Diane, won't eventually the market forces overwhelm this sort of political dysfunction Mark's talking about? It has in other states.
I think both the market source pressure and the and public opinion, because that is changing dramatically. I do think another takeaway is how passionate Mark is about marijuana in the state. That's sort of
yes, it is an interesting phenomenon that we've been noticing.
Well, you
through
know,
this discussion,
as he said, he's been working really hard. Y'all cut him some slack, you know. I wanted to make the point that some of the most interesting things that are going to be happening around Florida government won't actually be in session, but they have to do with the courts. One of them does have to do with Amendment 1, the Environmental Conservation Lands and Water Amendment that 75% of the people in Florida voted for, which is being ignored by the Florida legislature, or the money's being, you know, misused at DEP for stuff like insurance and office furniture. This is true stuff. There is a court case. It goes to trial in next July. And it hangs on a very interesting constitutional issue, which is paramount, the will of the people when they put something in the Constitution, or the absolute right of the legislature to appropriate funds. And that one's going to be one to watch.
The supporters both of the environmental spending amendment in 2014 and the medical marijuana amendment will say they were spurred on to action because of the inaction by the legislature to write it into the Constitution because lawmakers weren't taking it up in a way that public opinion polls and clearly the voters thought it should be.
They never do.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, I mean, that's whether it's that or the indoor smoking ban, for instance.
Right.
You know, these are just things that the legislature, when it goes to Tallahassee, is not doing the business of the people. It's doing the business of their campaign donors and those that generally finance the party. There are exceptions, however, when it comes to certain large interest groups who can sway their votes one way or another. But by and large, the business of the Florida legislature is the business of private government.
And as we've been talking about, even when the voters weigh in overwhelmingly with a constitutional amendment, their voice is not
Well, there was a
heard.
Classroom size amendment, too, that was ignored. They ignore amendments. Yeah. We've had years.
And let me just jump in. We're going to take a quick break and continue our look ahead to 2018 here on the Florida Roundup. Statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. Keep listening.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition 2018, the year ahead. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Tom, other big issues under consideration by lawmakers this year are definitely related to Hurricane Irma. Governor Scott's administration is being challenged over a rule that requires assisted living facilities to have generators and the ability to provide 96 hours of backup power. Now, attorneys for the Florida Senior Living Association are arguing that that proposed rule puts requirements on assisted living facilities that actually aren't authorized under state law.
Yeah, the Scott administration here says the move is designed to save lives, and the new rules follow the deaths of 14 residents at a Broward County nursing home 3 days after Hurricane Irma. A dozen of those deaths were ruled homicide. The rehabilitation center at Hollywood Hills lost its air conditioning, Melissa, and did not have enough backup power to cool the building for its patients.
And the ramifications of that tragedy are being felt around the state, Tom. Nursing homes, assisted living facilities, they're criticizing the new requirements because of the cost and the short time frame for getting everything in place. Now, lawmakers, when they go into session, are expected to consider several proposals related to requiring those generators and fuel supplies. And the new rules proposed by the Scott administration, of course, they would have to be approved by the legislature. As we continue our look now on the roundup at the biggest stories to watch in 2018, We're going to discuss this fallout from Irma as we welcome back our panel, Adam Smith, political editor at the Tampa Bay Times, Mark Caputo, who writes for Politico, and Diane Roberts of FSU, NPR, and Flamingo Magazine. Adam Smith, let's begin with you. What do you think these nursing homes are really worried about when we see this fussing over regulation in the wake of those deaths down in South Florida?
They're worried about cost and profits, which is what often the main interests are worried about in the legislature. You do have some irony. The governor, who's all about cutting back regulations, had been supportive until Irma, cutting back regulations on nursing homes. And now, after those horrific deaths, clearly he's on the other side. I think there's a decent chance he may not get what he wants through the legislature. But I think politically, as long as he's out there talking about saving lives, he'll be fine.
You think he'll sail right through this?
You know, I think it's iffy. I wouldn't want to predict that those requirements are going to get through the legislature. But I do think clearly public opinion is on the side of protecting seniors from being baked in nursing homes.
Of course.
That was pretty horrific.
Yeah, horrific. Yeah. Diane.
Well, I mean, I think there's absolutely no downside to arguing for protecting old people in nursing homes. That said, the nursing home lobby is large and powerful. So there's no guarantee, as Adam said, that the money will actually, you know, have to be spent on this stuff and that the legislature will act, because they can always pull out there, but we're anti-regulation and we're pro-free market and the market will take care of it. You know, because you fry a few old people and that place will go bankrupt. Well, you know, this is the logic of this, of course, is obscene, but it has happened before. The governor, I think, sees an opportunity here, though, to do something he hasn't been able to do in the past, which is to be a champion of the vulnerable. And I think, you know, if he pulls out the grandmother card, that's going to work well for him politically, no matter what the legislature does.
And going beyond that, Mark Caputo, what do you see the state doing this year when it comes to the hurricane response plan, any changes they might make? And what changes might we see in our property insurance, our taxes?
Property insurance is going to go up,
yeah.
Because the insurance market is by and large determined by the reinsurance market. That's insurance for insurance companies. And they incurred pretty big losses in Texas and Florida this year. So the challenge we're going to see is what happens to Citizens, which is the property insurer of last resort, which the state tried to kind of depopulate. That is, they wanted to shrink it because it was kind of sort of government-run insurance. Mm-hmm. But in doing that, they allowed lots of rates to go up for lots of other people and kind of try to push them out of Citizens. There's going to become a point where insurance just becomes more and more and more of your paycheck and of your monthly payment. And, you know, folks are starting to notice, and they're certainly going to start noticing more next year.
We may not have a state income tax in Florida, but we do have state property insurance and as well as car insurance. But what about the larger question of just general preparedness of the state of Florida? Hurricane Irma put everybody on notice that, as we've said previously with this panel, the state was kind of rusty when it came to preparation.
I guess. I'm trying to think of, like, you know, was FPL really rusty considering all of the power that got lost? But they seemed to get it up kind of quickly for a lot of people, not everybody.
Or is it that, let me ask all of you, is it that it's the kind of storm that was just so massive and affected so many thousands of miles that all the preparation in the world might not have been adequate?
It's a hurricane, people. I mean, I'm skeptical that government can solve this problem instantly.
We're going to have hurricanes.
All the preparation in the world would be adequate, but there were a lot of problems that were avoidable, and they do have a shortage of
What problems were avoidable?
Well, there's a shortage of emergency shelters. There were a lot of people that were untrained and for running those shelters. I think there are serious policy questions about letting charter schools build schools that are not up to the same hurricane standards that public schools have to deal with. So there's a lot
But maybe this goes back to what we were talking about earlier. Like, do you want to order such massive evacuations of people
during a hurricane? And let me just jump in and say you're listening to the Florida Roundup statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. Another issue we wanted to ask all three of you about, the three proposed gun bills. They were already rejected during committee meetings this fall in Tallahassee. Measures allowing people to bring weapons into a courthouse, a measure that would have reduced penalties for permit holders who temporarily open carry. Adam Smith, do you see any more attempts coming this session to loosening up gun laws in the state?
Seems like those attempts never stop coming. I've been surprised, frankly, that they haven't made more progress given the cloud of the NRA and the fear so many Republicans have of the NRA. So maybe we've reached a tipping point where there are a lot of Republicans that are willing to say this is a bridge too far, open carry and some things like that. So I think those committee votes were probably a sign that some of these proposals are going to have a tough time.
Caputo, you were giggling there.
There's also interesting is that the Senate president stocked the committees that would hear the gun bills with Republicans from Miami-Dade County who tend to not favor the same sort of gun freedom perceptions as, say, Republicans from Marion County, you know, farther north. So I do wonder to what degree Senate President Joe Negron kind of stacked the deck against the NRA, or better said, you know, it's Unified Sportsmen of Florida, the NRA in Florida. It does seem like these fail year after year, but the NRA also might be a victim of its own success.
Huh.
It had gotten so much over so many years that it's left kind of at the margins of these things, like, you know, campus carry. You know, that's not as big a deal as, say,
Diane,
weapons.
What about some of the officials around the state, like the state attorney in Hillsborough County? He's saying it's time to take the guns out of domestic violence defendants, for example. That's a movement that's getting traction beyond Florida as well.
Well, why on earth we don't stop people who have been convicted of domestic violence from owning guns is beyond me. We're very quick to stop people from voting, say, a useful thing to do. But just about anybody can have a gun almost anywhere, a less useful thing. And I mean, I teach on a university campus. The idea that people who can have a concealed carry permit, you know, which you can get when you're 21, would be marching around campus, a college campus. Maybe they don't know what goes on college campuses. You know, it's a little hotbed of roiling hormones, booze, drugs, strong opinions, rage, jealousy, love. You know,
so boring.
So boring. And guns? Oh, well, wouldn't that just make it so much better? No, I think that these bills will come up over and over and over again. And we've seen it before. United Sportsmen of Florida, led by Marion Hammer, they aren't going anywhere, sadly. And they're not in the ascendant this year because of Joe Negron, thank God. Because I don't want to be facing a classroom where, you know, I got to have my AK because everybody else is packing. That's just absurd.
I would just throw in a token for the proposal in Hillsborough. I think that's going to be popular in Hillsborough. But I think there are real questions about the enforcement of that and how are you going to retrieve guns from everybody who's got a domestic violence? How are you going to enforce it? Is that really more of a symbolic measure than a practical and effective one?
Finally, let me ask about an issue that Diane alluded to, which is voter access. So 2018 is, of course, an election year. Is there anything afoot in Tallahassee regarding voter access and poll access? Florida has been challenged in that in the past. Mark, have you heard anything in regards to that issue?
I'm sorry to be kind of like Governor Scott here and actually tell you what I'm focused on. I've been a little more interested in the Broward County's election supervisors under fire in three separate lawsuits.
Brendan Snipes, sure.
Right. Yeah. And
it's a local issue.
Well, it's a local issue. This is Florida's second largest county, and we're starting to see more and more alleged ballot problems that are leading to lawsuits there. And there are a number of unanswered questions, and I think Florida's governor is going to start looking more into her office. So if we're going to see any sort of elections controversy, it's going to be kind of originate more out of Broward County than I see statewide.
It's going to be a busy year ahead, and we appreciate all three of you so much for giving us incredible insights. Thank you so much to Mark Caputo of Politico, Diane Roberts at FSU, Adam Smith of the Tampa Bay Times. So great to have you on the Florida Roundup. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and that is our show for today. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Gina Jordan and Kevin Merschart are producers.
With engineering help from WLRN's program director, Peter Meritz. Our theme music is by Miami musician Aaron Libos.
I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Have a great new year. We'll talk with you next week.